Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence who has, I'm deeply grateful to be able to say, he has brought to bear in connection with one of the most important public policy challenges we're facing, with great implication for our country as well as the war for the free world, is Dr. David Clements. He is a professor of law at New Mexico State University. He's a former deputy district attorney out in his state of New Mexico, and a man who has deeply studied what went down in the 2020 elections and what are the implications both for, well, the outcome of those various races as well as our future elections. He is the master of a marvelous blog resource, The Professor's Record, where you can follow closely his running commentary on what is happening as we speak. And we're going to drill down on some of that with him today. Dr. Clements, it's great to have you back. Thank you so much for taking some time with us today at Secure Freedom Radio.
My pleasure, Frank.
I want to start with the Arizona forensic audit that's taking place. I know you're following this very closely. What's the status of it, and what do you think the prospects are that it will get to the ground truth about what happened on November 3rd out in that state?
Here's the latest. They restarted the audit after about a week break. They're examining IT breaches and 400 tabulation machines. They're basically over the 50% mark. They've counted over 1 million ballots. And the latest development there is that they're considering expansion of the audit to all of the races in 2020. Right now, they've been focusing on the presidential and Senate races. And translation, this means that they can get far more data points to see if there are any discrepancies with what the tabulators are showing. They've added a third shift, so things are moving a lot quickly, or more quickly than they were before. And interestingly enough, a Pennsylvania delegation has traveled to tour the facilities and receive a brief by the forensic audit team. So Pennsylvania is interested. Other states are looking looking to Arizona to see if it makes sense for them to do an audit in their own respective states.
And are you persuaded that the quality control that is being provided in terms of both security and the performance of this forensic audit will withstand scrutiny? We're hearing a lot of criticism from the Secretary of State there, a Democrat, and there have been rumblings from the federal government, the Justice Department as well, that they're not happy with what's being done here.
Well, unfortunately, it's become a very highly partisan talking point war. What I can tell you is that the Pennsylvania delegation that traveled there was very impressed with the setup. In my opinion, this is the gold standard for audits. If you compare it to New Hampshire, which we might talk about later, there's no comparison between what we have in place. We've got 9 security camera feeds that are going around 24/7 that you can monitor, color-coordinated teams that have specific functions. For the folks that are commenting on, you know, there being a lax audit procedure there, they just don't know what they're talking about.
And in terms of chain of custody and security and issues like that, you're satisfied that it's measuring up to what's needed?
Yes. The Senate liaison, Ken Benet, has done everything he can to ensure that there are no custody issues. If there are custody issues, it's a problem from that's been created by the Maricopa Board of County Supervisors. They were not cooperative from day one. So if there's going to be any issues about the quality of the chain of custody, you really have to look towards them. But since the audit and the machines and the ballots have been turned over to the legislature, they've done an impeccable job.
Wonderful. That brings me to Georgia, where chain of custody issues have arisen with respect to the ballots there and efforts to conduct some kind of more rigorous examination of them as well. Is that right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, there was a security lapse at the Fulton County warehouse. Judge Amaro has issued a second order, which allows for independent security. And the reason why is because the sheriff there promised 24/7 security. Yet we know that there was a report that the alarm to that warehouse sounded and no one from the sheriff's office showed up for 4 hours. A private security company had to show up. So the latest is that the lawyers are seeking out video surveillance and are seeking contempt of court proceedings that they want to file against Fulton County personnel.
Do you think that the opportunity to evaluate what happened in that election in perhaps a manner akin to the forensic audit of Arizona is now been foreclosed by a security breach?
Well, it's too soon to say. I mean, who knows what happens when you've got some a place open to, to what we'd say, mischief could happen. So let's just say that 4 hours, there's a lot of stuff that could occur. Just like in Arizona, we had lots of things like that mysterious fire and shredded ballots found in a dumpster. How it's going to play out, who knows? But the intent there is to do a forensic audit similar to what's occurring in Arizona. So when you've got 50 states and only a handful of them are actually pursuing a full forensic audit, I'm encouraged regardless.
Good. All right. You mentioned New Hampshire. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there, and particularly if you could introduce this story of Kill Chain, a documentary movie that was released shortly before the 2020 election, which I found to be very interesting and illuminating. The prime mover behind it is a fellow by the name of Harry Hirsty. Tell us what he's doing these days and how it jives with the important revelations of that film.
Well, the salient point out of New Hampshire is that the audit has come under immense scrutiny from people that are on the scene at ground level. You don't see scrutiny from the mainstream media or from Rachel Maddow, but there are a lot of odd and bizarre things that are happening. Harry Hirsty and Philip Stark are the auditors that are doing the audit there. And what's problematic is that Harry Hirsty back in, earlier in the year through that Kill Chain documentary, about the 1 hour and 7 minute mark, they discuss a machine anomaly in Georgia. That's where they did the Hirsty hack and some other things. And they show that in a heavily Democratic precinct that there was one machine out of seven that showed Republicans winning down ballot. And they suggested that it was nearly impossible for this to occur. And it means that the machine had malware on it. So translation, they said that there was a 1 in a million statistical probability of this occurring. Well, oddly enough, this same phenomena is happening in New Hampshire. They've got four machines that they've looked at, and there's one machine that's completely out of kilter. So that's something that's concerning. Now, Hirsty's been pressed on this, and he's got a technical answer for just about everything. But things that are very concerning is that on May 12th of this year, Harry Hirsty reset the memory cards. He cleared the counters. He backdated to the election, in particular on this machine, on November 4th, which is a no-no.
Doctor, hold that thought, because this seems to be highly irregular, shall we say, and the implications of it are something I want to explore with you on the other side of a very short break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. David Clements, the professor's record meister, and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with an extraordinary man who has been doing extraordinarily important work on the election integrity issues that have arisen in the 2020 election. His name is Dr. David Clements. He's a professor of law, a former prosecutor at the state level in New Mexico, and a man who is the proprietor of the Professor's Record, which is really an extremely impressive and important resource for those of us who are trying to keep apprised of what's happening with respect to the 2020 election, most especially. But also, we're going to talk with him a bit about what's next, what will assure, hopefully, free and fair elections in this country in the future. Dr. Clements, you were talking about this fellow Harry Hirsty and some steps that he seems to have taken in connection with I guess, the audit now underway in New Hampshire, which was not one of the states that was deemed to be in, you know, controversy over the 2020 election. And yet, on closer examination, there does seem to be some things that have required closer scrutiny. What exactly is Harry doing? And here I thought in the 2020 documentary, Kill Chain, he was all about election integrity. He was very concerned that these machines could be manipulated for nefarious purposes. Was that just because he thought Donald Trump would do it?
I think so. We had a lot of people that were concerned about election integrity when Trump was in office, Harry Hursty among them. We have a video of Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris all talking about election vulnerabilities, and then Trump wins, and then the narrative has morphed into our elections being the safest and most secure. So I can't reconcile the discrepancy.
Nothing to see here, folks. Move along.
Yeah, nothing to see there. What's problematic about Harry Hursty resetting the memory card and clearing the counters and backdating to the date is that while he's got a technical explanation for it now, if you just look at his own words in the Kill Chain documentary, we're seeing the same exact phenomenon from that movie take place in New Hampshire. And so in some respects, you know, he's already made his record and he's been pressed on it and he's been avoiding any discussion about this machine too. That's the one that has these major anomalies on the vote counts. So we're keeping an eye on that. The other thing that...
Are the anomalies... This is always the question that arises ultimately. Are the anomalies sufficient to call into question the outcome of the election, or are they simply suggestive that there may be other problems that taken together?
Well, probably not outcome determinative from a national landscape, but I've been given a lot of thought to this. I think that the significance of New Hampshire is that when you look at early battleground states, you start with Iowa, then New Hampshire. So usually a grassroots candidate, if they've got momentum because they've done well in Iowa and New Hampshire, and if they don't, their fortunes are over. So you typically have to get through there. So, when we look at election integrity, I know we've been focusing a lot on the swing states. New Hampshire's key. A lot of people can't get out the gate unless they do well there. And so there might be a reason why there's focus on the efforts that are going on there. The major point that I think that I would like to focus on, though, is that these auditors, when they're pressed for questions by the people, they're just nowhere to be found. And so, for example,
these are the guys like Hursty in New Hampshire you're talking about.
Yes, Hursty and Philip Stark. There was a surveillance footage blackout. They won't explain to us why the surveillance went out. The timing was awfully, awfully suspicious. They were asked about whether they're...
This is in the audit you're talking about?
Yes, during the audit. There was surveillance footage, and there was a gentleman from the Attorney General's office that happened to be there when the cameras came on, and we asked them for information about what occurred there. That was not forthcoming. And then I asked them a question about internet access, and they were triggered by the questions, claiming that there's no way that these machines could be accessed by the internet. Well, we've secured the AccuVote operating system manual that was used for these machines, and they are equipped with modems. They can be equipped with modems, and they also have what's known as a PCMCIA slot, which enables you to throw anything into it and connect it with the internet. I just thought that the reaction to the question was telling, so we've been pursuing that. They basically made a promise.
It's particularly telling, if I may interrupt you, just to say, in the film The Kill Chain, Harry Hursty himself talks about the ease with which machines like these, at least, if not these specific machines, can in fact be hooked up to the internet and can be manipulated. I must say this is quite puzzling to me, and it's again, I guess, speaks to the point you made earlier, Dr. Clements, that it depends on whose ox is being gored or potentially being gored, whether these people are concerned about the potential for election irregularities or not. Which brings me to the topic that I do want to cover with you at least briefly, which is what are the prospects for election integrity going forward? Obviously, we need a baseline of what the problems were in the last election to ensure that we do whatever we can to prevent them from recurring. But how do you see the various state-level efforts? Texas has been in the news of late, for example, to get some of the lessons from the 2020 election learned and applied so that we don't have them repeated. On the one hand, at the state levels, principally. And on the other hand, the efforts, it seems, at the federal level by Democrats in the Congress and the Biden administration to ensure that we do have the similar kinds of problems permanently.
Yeah, I think I'm encouraged because there's been a sea change in attitude by we the people. And what do I mean by that? Before, we just implicitly trusted the system. We thought that there might have been minor levels of fraud, and that's someone else's problem. Just complain to your politician. I'm seeing a level of engagement that I've just never observed before, where people are becoming election law experts. That New Hampshire story that I talked to you was broken by citizen journalists, a guy by the name of Nick Meseder, George Behezy, and Brian Lupo. And they're watching and monitoring everything. And that's happening in Arizona. It's happening in Texas. And so people have just come to the point where, like, look, you can tell us and give us whatever talking points you want through the mainstream media. We're not buying it. And so there's been a relentless push for accountability, and I've never seen anything of this nature before. So I'm extremely encouraged because there's just no quit in this group of patriots. And they don't care about whether the outcome says that a Republican wins or a Democrat wins. They just want to have faith in their election. So oddly enough, I think over the past month, we've turned a corner. And if Pennsylvania is sending a delegation any sign, I think we're on the right path. The other benefit that I would say is that Wisconsin also has been tightening measures. They've got an assembly of Bill 198, where there the scuttlebutt was that election clerks were curing ballot errors instead of letting the voters do that. Now they're trying to make that a law. So we're seeing little fixes, big and small. And I feel good about that, Frank.
That's encouraging. We do want to see them carry through, needless to say. It's one thing to get bills, you know, ready and considered, but not to get them enacted is the difference, as Mark Twain used to say, between lightning and lightning bugs. So it's promising, and I hope you're right that this will translate into real change at the state level. Let's talk about the federal level quickly, if we can, Doctor. One of the things that, as you know, has happened is there's been this major piece of legislation, H.R. 1 in the House, S. 1 in the Senate. We're now hearing Chuck Schumer is intent on getting a vote on it. Not clear that he has the votes on getting it through, unless they dispense with the filibuster. There seems to be another gambit in the works, though, and I'd like you to talk about both, if you could, quickly. The second is what I kind of think of as a bait and switch, where look over there, folks, at that monster bill, 800 pages long or whatever, H.R. 1, S1. But the real action is going to be something called the John Lewis Voting Rights Enhancement Act. If you could talk us through both of those quickly and what they portend if they were to become law, I'd be very grateful.
Well, I'm a political outsider, but one thing I would tell you is that anytime you get a title of a bill like that, just assume the opposite, that it's not going to be enhancement. It's going to be something that's going to provide greater challenges to election integrity. So you're right. I don't believe that H.R. 1's going to pass. I could be wrong. Constituents are getting more and more upset. And I think even Democrats, more and more Democrats are starting to question the election results, maybe not to the same degree as Republicans. So I would be surprised if H.R. 1 gets the necessary votes, especially if you're going to die on a hill. Election integrity is probably not going to be the right avenue for that. But I could be wrong.
Well, it certainly seems as though people recognize that if they don't fix these elections, if they don't rig them, the Democrats may not prevail in 2022. So I do think that's concentrating their minds and in a way that may not be in the interest of the nation. But make your second point, if you would, about this John Lewis Enhancement Act, if you could.
Well, before people are worried about H.R. 1, remember, there's got to be an interplay with the state legislatures. And a lot of these state legislatures are realizing we really screwed up by, you know, entering into consent decrees or having unaccountable Secretary of States change the rules. And so there's been a tightening up there. So there are federal powers where they can try to lay out the election policies that they want. But there's got to be a discussion with the state legislatures. And I expect ones that are controlled by Republicans to push back. With respect to the Enhancement Act, you know, in all candidness, Frank, I'm not an expert of that one just yet. I know that as of late, it looks like the Biden administration has tasked Kamala Harris with kind of quelling concerns over elections. They're using race as an issue, surprise, surprise. In particular, Biden has been mentioning about white supremacy and basically doing a parody of Trump supporters in as a justification to have Harris investigate, much like she was sent to solve the border crisis. She didn't do much there. I don't expect that she's going to be able to do much.
If this legislation is brought forward from the Congress, it will essentially give the Attorney General of the United States the authority to implement everything that's in H.R. 1S1. So it bears very close watching and opposition as well, it seems to me. We have to leave it at that. David Clements, thank you very much for your time today and for the extraordinary contribution you're making to all of us and our country by the close monitoring and analysis that you're doing at The Professor's Record, a really valuable blog resource that I commend to all of you. Come back to us again with updates, if you would, sir, very soon. It's good to talk with you. Next up, we'll speak with Dakota Wood, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marines Reserve, retired. He is our duty expert on the military, and we'll talk with him next about what's going on inside the Defense Department to take it down. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a distinct pleasure to say we are joined by a man whose time in uniform was quite remarkable. And his time now writing about the sorts of things he worked on while he was in the United States Marine Corps, in his current capacity as a senior research fellow for defense programs at the esteemed Heritage Foundation, is, if anything, as remarkable and certainly as needed as what he did for us in the Marines. Dakota Wood is his name. He rose through the ranks to the esteemed position of a lieutenant colonel. He is now retired, but he is bringing to bear his insights as a strategic planner and expert on budgetary affairs to help the rest of us understand what is the actual status of our military and its adequacy to the kinds of threats that we're facing around the world today. He is the editor of a remarkable product of the Heritage Foundation. It's called the Index of U.S. Military Strength, the 2021 edition of which is now out. And it's always a great privilege, really, to have a chance to visit with him. Dakota Wood, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, sir.
Frank, it's always a delight to be with you. Thanks for having me on and for these types of issues that you bring to America's attention. So, it's long-term longevity and security of our country hang in the balance, and just applaud you for raising these sorts of things.
Amen. Well, listen, it's the ability to bring people like you to the microphone that make it possible to do that. So let's talk a little bit about, we're going to have two blocks of the show with you, and I'm very appreciative of that. In the first, I wanted to really explore with you one of the most important essays I've seen in a long time. It's entitled The Woke Takeover of the U.S. Military Endangers Us All. You can find it now on the Heritage Foundation website. Appeared originally on the 25th of May in the New York Post. You co-authored it with one of your very valued colleagues there at Heritage, Mike Gonzalez, who I hope to have on the show for an extended period here shortly as well. But talk a little bit about what you mean when you say the woke takeover of the U.S. military, and then we'll get into how dangerous it is.
Public awareness of this issue, that wasn't spurred by, but it was really amplified by the firing of the U.S. Space Force Lieutenant Colonel by the name of Lohmeyer. He was in charge, command of a unit, and he had self-published a book talking about this Marxist ideology that's being imposed upon the military. And, the training sessions that he was involved in and the messaging that he had heard from his chain of command, from the Secretary of Defense on down through the ranks. And so he was concerned about it, wrote this book, and then he'd been featured on various podcasts. And it was a result of the visibility of the issue that he had brought to it. The military chain of command came down and relieved him of duty without really clear explanation, just a loss of trust and confidence. So Mike and I looked into this. We thought, well, what did he say? We listened to the podcast, nothing objectionable in terms of, insulting the chain of command or anything like that. But what it comes down
to the contrary, as I recall, he actually complimented the chain of command.
Absolutely. And so what he was talking about, and the point of your question is, what are these ideas that are being forced upon the military by the administration and by advocates of critical race theory, and gender identity and, these chosen kind of paths in life that might not square with the more conservative points of view that generally characterize the military. And, this, especially in the critical race theory.
Traditional values, as they're called.
Yeah, traditional values, this idea of white guilt, the idea that racism has been built into, was codified by the U.S. Constitution, and is built into the very fabric and social and legal structures of the United States. So these are the things, this class warfare, oppressed versus oppressor, right, that are being introduced into the military. And when you think about the military, it's team building, right? It's unity. It's there is a country that I love and that I want to defend and potentially lay down my life for.
Yeah, but you swear an oath to support and defend that constitution that is supposedly a racist document?
That's absolutely right. So here you have in a unit, Polynesians, blacks, European descent, American Indians. I mean, this whole beautiful mix of youth from across the country, different economic backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, and they put on the uniform, they go through the same training, they receive the same orders, they salute smartly and try to execute to the best of their ability. So when you start introducing ideas that says, hey, you white guys should feel guilty, you black guys should be feel like you're oppressed, you Indian ethnic background folks, have always been on the sidelines. Japanese background people, should feel that haven't been treated properly. I mean, whatever the interest group is.
Fostering resentments throughout the ranks, in other words.
Resentment, division, independent identities that work against the idea of team building. The fact that the unit leader might have come from a particular racial or ethnic or social or religious background should have no bearing on whether or not their orders are followed, right?
All of these folks
desire to serve.
Yeah, implicit in what you've said, but just to make it explicit, all of these folks have an opportunity, the same opportunity, to excel, to be advanced on the basis of merit. The content of their character and their performance, in other words, as Martin Luther King might have said, and not their color of skin or ethnic background or what have you. And so this is a point I've spent a lot of time working with of late, a distinguished group of military officers operating together now under the banner of something called the Flag Officers for America, Dakota. And like you, and like me for that matter, though as a civilian, we all swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And they feel that that's a continuing obligation. And they've been very troubled by this because they feel that what is being done to the military, and I think you and Mike Gonzalez have said the same, is potentially utterly incompatible, not only with unit cohesion and good order and discipline and all that, but with the readiness and the warfighting capability and therefore the deterrent capability of our military. Talk about that, if you would, in a very dangerous world. Is that something we can actually afford to do?
It is. If the military turns on itself, if you pit groups within the military against each other, and you start to question why somebody was promoted or put into a position, doesn't that break down unit cohesion and discipline and a willingness to follow orders and to do what needs to be done? So if you're an external player like China or Russia, and you see this tumult, this erosion of discipline and cohesion and unit effectiveness within the military, it has you thinking, this is not the military of the 1940s or the 1960s or 1980s, right? I mean, it doesn't have the wherewithal to really take to the field and to be able to trust itself, and therefore won't be effective on the battlefield. And so it creates opportunities, erodes deterrence, as you said, and causes countries like Iran and North Korea to think now is the moment to move and to do very dangerous things in the world because the United States is so distracted, right? And so self-flagellating, over these perceived ills that they won't be able to respond to that. And here's the point, Frank, is that the ideologies being opposed, these Marxist ideologies, aren't even rooted in the factual reality of what's going on in the world. There isn't another country on the planet that has the diversity in population that the United States does, right? The heterogeneity that is the beautiful part of America, the opportunity and quality of life and freedom of speech. You go to any other country in the world, and 90 some odd some odd percent, there's going to be a homogeneous culture, right? They all look fairly the same. They all have the same upbringings and all that stuff. And it's very hard for any other group of people to be introduced and to assimilate. Japan really has a serious problem with this. South Koreans do. The French do, right? And so the America in our 200 plus years has been the shining example of opportunity and equality. We even had a war amongst ourselves to ensure that. It's a beautiful melting pot. And so these ideas that we're inherently racist, that we are systemically keeping people from rising, you know, to the top of whatever profession that they want to go into is nonsense. And the military is the best example of America as the best example. And that you can come from anywhere in the world based on merit, capability, willingness to throw in with the team, and you can rise to the very top levels of military power.
Which is one of the reasons why the Marxists are so determined to take down the military, as it is a shining example. It enshrines these values. Its uniform code of military justice essentially is all about assuring that this is the way that the military will operate. So they have to tear it apart, but it also has the double benefit, as far as they're concerned, of course, making us more vulnerable to their predations.
And yeah, I really wanted to jump on this, okay, because bringing up this issue, and you and I talked a little bit about it before the program, is that if you're a Marxist or somebody wants to tear down America, the military is the best tool to do that because it is an institution that prizes civilian control of the military. It doesn't chart its own course. I mean, we don't want a military that looks at the commander in chief, you know, the president, right, and decides not to follow an order, right?
So unless it is an unlawful one, that right is preserved.
Unless it's an unlawful order, that in this case, we would have to show that it's legal or not legal. So the military, if you can impose things upon it, it's a way to normalize or introduce these divisive ideologies in ways that affect all of America because it's a federal entity and these men and women deploy not only across the country, but across the world. So it's up to people like you and me and others outside the military to say things that perhaps the military can't say for itself because it does exist in a structure where you're following orders and you're not supposed to, you know, be bad-mouthing or criticizing the chain of command from inside. Does that make sense?
It does indeed. And I think it's why we feel so appreciative of the work that you do, Dakota Wood, Mike Gonzalez, the others at Heritage, and the ability to use this platform to help give voice to those in the uniform who can't speak for themselves. And such a manner as this, witness what happened with Matt Lohmeyer. But we are trying to do what we can to shine light on specifically this fellow Bishop Garrison and this countering extremism working group, which is being used with the help of the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League and the Muslim Brotherhood to purge patriots from the military. This has to be called out. I believe it has to be shut down as well. More on that in a moment.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The true face of the Chinese Communist Party was exposed 32 years ago tonight in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Conservatively, 10,000 people were massacred there by the CCP's military as they demonstrated for democracy around a version of our Statue of Liberty. To its eternal shame, the George H.W. Bush administration immediately dispatched National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft to assure the Chinese communists that we wouldn't allow their mass murder to interfere with business as usual. The rest, as they say, is history. The CCP took our measure, found our leaders and elites to be corrupt, unprincipled and weak, and furiously pursued the destruction of our country and world domination ever since. We must now prove them wrong, or as Ronald Reagan said, we'll be reduced to telling our children what it was like to live in America when men were free. This is Frank Gaffney.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're continuing a remarkable and, I think, very important conversation with a man I admire greatly. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marine Corps retired. He is now a senior research fellow specializing in defense policy and programs at the Heritage Foundation. And we've just been visiting about, what I think of as an enemy within problem inside the United States Armed Forces. We're going to turn now to talking about some of the enemies without, enemies that are much in evidence, unfortunately, at this moment around the world, and seemingly seeing an opportunity to behave aggressively at our expense and that of other freedom-loving folks. Let me ask you, Dakota, if I might, as a man who has very closely followed our military forces and capabilities, this is, of course, the subject of your Index of Military Strength, what are the implications that the only United States carrier and its battle group in the Pacific Fleet is now being sent off to Afghanistan to try to facilitate and perhaps to some extent compensate for President Biden's decision to withdraw the remaining forces from the ground there?
It's a wonderful example of the multiple factors that influence the perception of military power and the utility of military power. If you only have one carrier battle group in the Pacific, as important as the Pacific is, what does that say about the size of our fleet? You know, that we can't be able to surge something to cover down in this requirement to be able to provide supporting fires for the withdrawal from Afghanistan, right? That the Reagan has to make that transit, and we don't have anything else in the barn that we can to send out to replace it or to take care of the job, near Afghanistan. So it talks about fleet size. You know, in the 1980s, we were near 600 ships. Today, we're below 300. And our shipyards are in such a poor state of repair that ships will sit in port waiting on their maintenance availability for months, if not years. So it tells you about the availability of ships and the number. So that's number one. You have a ship and it's waiting 2 years to even get into the maintenance, and then it takes far longer because more problems have cropped up. And so instead of it being in the yards for 6 months, it's there for 9 months or a year. So having one carrier battle group having to make this strategic shift and leaving that part of the world uncovered with that sort of naval power is a powerful representation of the problems we have back here at home. Two, it's a perception thing, right? That our enemies, our adversaries, you know, we talked about deterrence earlier. What does this say about the ability of the United States to make good on alliance promises to Japan, South Korea, and others? Wouldn't the Chinese, I mean, they can count better than we can, I think, in most cases. And they say, wow, the U.S. can't cover down on an obligation. So does that degrade deterrence? Yes, it does. And does it invite opportunism? And I think the answer is yes in both of those cases.
And it's coming against the backdrop.
Carrier battle group to cover the withdrawal from Afghanistan is another whole issue about how things were handled in Afghanistan for 20 years. And the reality, and this is another point here, is that the reality of warfare, the reality of military operations is a lot different than the theories and the bright, shiny ideas that people might have when they're formulating all these crazy foreign policy proposals. And that withdrawal from a combat zone is often the more dangerous part, right? Even more so than perhaps introducing forces. And so as you draw down your capabilities on land, you want to be able to protect your forces when they're in the most vulnerable positions. You have to have some kind of capability that does that, which says naval air power remains important, regardless of the debates over the survivability of the carrier and those sorts of things, that if we had land bases nearby, then we would cover that withdrawal with land-based air power, right? So you find yourself in situations in the real world where tools that people have said were not viable for many, many years now all of a sudden become critically important. So if it's important enough to provide covering air power in Afghanistan, and the only resource you have in that part of the world is to pull it from the Pacific with all of the downsides to doing that, what does that say about the state of our military, right? And our defense budget, the size of our fleets, and all those sorts of things. So it's a huge example that covers a multitude of factors that don't get enough ability.
Dakota, let me just draw you out on something that was implicit in what you just said. It's not just that it's considered to be important to have air power covering our withdrawal from Afghanistan. It's that it's necessary. And the reason it's necessary is because the enemy hasn't given up. And one of the things, you hear this all the time as well, that we have to just stop these endless wars. And it's even from the mouths of some people in the military, and I get that. They're tired of this Afghanistan debacle. I think all of us are. But the point is that the enemy gets a vote. And if you withdraw, having not defeated that enemy, and they are still in the field, and they are still active, including active perhaps against you as you withdraw, certainly against your allies in Afghanistan, you will find yourself losing that endless war. And that has very considerable effects, too. I'm reminded, and I'm sure this is a vivid imprint on your experience. I don't think you were of an age to fight in it, but you certainly lived through the repercussions of Vietnam. And our loss of Vietnam, our defeat in Vietnam, not militarily, but politically, and what flowed from it, whether it was the image of the iconic, horrifying image of people being desperately lifted off that embassy, or whether it was the domino effect that did happen when the communists used what they did with that victory in Vietnam to murder tens of millions of people elsewhere in the region. So these are the sorts of things that make me very anxious about what's happening in Afghanistan, I have to say. And your point about how what we have to do there is connected to what we have to do in the Pacific is a very, very compelling point as well, I think.
So this is the importance of well-thought-out strategy and being serious every single day, not being distracted by things when problems like this come up. So military power is not an infinite resource. I mean, you consume that. You consume popular goodwill. You consume the perceptions of America as being effective. So when you decide...
And the wherewithal of your forces, too. And you've documented this problem better than just about anybody.
Right. So I've got X number of airplanes. If I'm flying them at combat rates for years on end, I will use up the life of that plane, which means the plane has to be replaced. So the average age of an Air Force fighter today is 30 years old. Who drives a 30-year-old car? Right. So if we're not willing to fund replacement of the assets that we're using, then you have to be very circumspect about using them in the first place, if that makes sense. And, you know, the criticism of Afghanistan was it's not been a 20-year war. It's been 21-year wars because we kept adding on requirements to our forces. It wasn't just defeating the Taliban. Now it's building schools and now it's building roads and putting in power stations and trying to take, you know, an 8th century culture and bring it into the 21st century. So when you start adding requirements, nation building, right? So is it defeating the enemy? Is that the priority? Or is it turning Afghanistan into a Western European representative democracy, right? So all of these things are noble, but your bank account is limited. You're using up time and goodwill and resources, wearing out your people and all those sorts of things. So we have to be very judicious when we use military power, understanding the long-term consequences. So where we find ourselves today, after 20 years in Afghanistan, is having to pull a carrier battle from nearby China, right, and sending it to Afghanistan. That's where we are at because of the parlous state of affairs in the U.S. military.
I'm sorry to say, I've got about 20 other things I want to talk to you about, and we've got no time to do it. But I did just want to introduce a topic for hopefully a next conversation soon, and that is, against this backdrop of using up our military and not investing in it on an ongoing basis to assure its continued ability to meet the evolving threats of our time. A prime example of this, of course, is our nuclear deterrent forces.
Thanks for bringing up the nuclear issue. I think it is very instructive that the Biden administration is pursuing the Trump administration's investment decisions and modernizing the nuclear portfolio. So if things were good in our nuclear establishment, why would the Joe Biden administration anger the progressive left by continuing the Trump administration's spending patterns, you know, on the nuclear triad, nuclear infrastructure, et cetera? So I think it is very revealing about the true state of our nuclear capabilities and how our competitors might be viewing the nuclear deterrence capability that we have so prized and has guaranteed Western security for the last half century or more.
Thank you for your time today. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for the great work you do today at Heritage and have done for the United States Marine Corps and for all of us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.